I begin sort of appropriately enough with a sort of an epistolary apology for change in title. I was, when I accepted this invitation to speak a year ago, I was working on postal conditions, and my research has sort of moved away from that. This still has a lot to do with postal conditions, and I've got some material in here that will speak to that, so hopefully I won't disappoint too many of you who are here to hear that. But this is really something of a crossroads paper that is sort of the terminal point of the book that's just about to come out on the material letter, and the new project, which looks at the scribal circulation of letters. And it's culled from a much larger chapter, of about 25,000 words, looking at the scribal circulation of letters, which treats in depth the range of letters that were scribally copied, the mechanisms of their circulation, and a large section on their reading and reception. But it's about the what I'm going to concentrate on today is really the mechanics of transmission, which is where the stuff on the post will come in. Now, this paper seeks to elucidate the mechanisms by which hundreds of manuscript copies of letters were scribally circulated from the late Elizabethan period onwards. It argues that letters were disseminated in ways broadly similar to other texts, such as verse, libels, and prose, utilising the kinds of networks and modes of transmission that have been fleshed out in major studies by scholars such as Mary Hobbs, Harold Love, Arthur Marotti, H.R. Woodhousen, and Peter Beale. The starting point for my analysis is a simplified model of scribal publication of new texts, which is typically characterised by a series of phases that extended from authorially controlled dissemination through stages of private, unrestricted copying to professional scribal production and later phases of print publication. At each stage, a work was likely to be incorporated into a larger bibliographic unit. At first, a linked group of a small number of related works, next, the personal miscellany or commonplace book, and lastly, the professionally copied anthology or aggregation. This distinctly Lovian framework of scribal publication, often used to describe the textual transmission of more straightforwardly literary texts, fits in general terms what happened to certain copies of letters as they moved from private modes of production to more public forms of consumption. Furthermore, several explanatory models of the nature of manuscript circulation have been forwarded, and on which this paper draws: the closely defined coterie, the scribal community, and more nebulously, the manuscript networks. While scholars are becoming increasingly sceptical of coterie circulation as an exploration for manuscript transmission, this paper will suggest that it is useful in characterising certain aspects of the dissemination of manuscript separates, but that it hardly explains the wider currency achieved by letters circulating indiscriminately and in informal but genuinely national scribal networks. The paper then first seeks to elucidate the broad range of letters that were scribally copied before examining the mechanics of circulation of items that travelled as manuscript separates, as part of larger bibliographic manuscript compilations such as pamphlets of related correspondence, collections of general letters and miscellanies, as well as printed collections. It attempts to highlight the manuscript forms and writing technologies that facilitated circulation and to sketch the complex textual afterlives of letters beyond the contemporary contexts of composition, delivery, and reading. As such, it problematizes the standard model of epistolarity, an ugly phrase, but literally the letterness of letters, which conceptualises early modern letter writing as a two-way epistolary exchange anchored within an historically specific moment. It also complicates how we understand the reading of letters and how we think about the letter as an intrinsically private and personal form of communication. What survives in early modern archives is therefore a complex range of manuscripts of widely differing formats. While Claudio Guillen has distinguished at least 7 kinds of letters in terms of genre, it is possible to delineate further subcategories of letter by paying attention to their scribal status. The original or sent letter, the rough draft, the personal copy, the letter book, the circular letter, the scribally published letter, and the printed letter. And I will draw on all of these in what I'm going to say this afternoon. The range of epistolary materials that circulated, copied, and collected was diverse in nature, broadly reflecting political, historical, and religious interests of the early modern period. The letters that achieved widest currency were those associated with monarchs, especially Elizabeth I, James I, and Charles I, but also well-known politicians, public figures or bodies, and institutions such as Parliament and the Privy Council, the universities, and with identifiable groups such as the Catholics of England, whose petition to James I for toleration was widely copied. Of individuals whose letters were most circulated, the most prominent are people like Walter Raleigh, Philip Sidney, Robert Devereux, the second Earl of Essex, and Francis Bacon. Letters connected to what might broadly be called matters of state achieved considerable currency in manuscript before being printed in the Kabbalah in the second half of the 17th century. These include Francis Tresham's letter to William Parker, warning him of the gunpowder plot, Lord Rochester's letter to Mr. Overbury on the death of his son Thomas, and the Countess of Nottingham's letter to Sir Andrew Sinclair, touching some words uttered by the King of Denmark against her honour. Letters of a more overtly religious nature were also copied, circulating alongside prayers, psalms, sermons, and religious verse. These include letters of continental reformers such as Calvin and Peter Martyr, and English Puritan divines like Edward Deering and Joseph Hall, as well as the correspondence of English martyrs. Catholic-related texts were also circulated among underground Catholic scribal communities, as well as for anti-Catholic reasons. Among them were the Babington conspirator Chidiot Tichborne's letter to his wife the night before he suffered, and Robert Southwell's letter of exhortation to his father, as well as more anti-Catholic texts, such as a letter found amongst some Jesuits lately taken at Clerkenwell, London, and a copy of a letter which the devil sent to the Pope of Rome. The letter texts in circulation were thus diverse. Analysis of reception identifies several main reasons for which copies of letters were read and consumed, which can broadly be summarised as emulatory or literary, religious or spiritual, antiquarian, acquisitive and historical, news-related and sensationalist, and legalistic and political. Now, I've summarised about 8,000 words in a sentence there, so I would be very happy to elaborate on that in roundtable discussion afterwards. In most cases, the ostensibly private nature of the letters that circulated precluded their publication in print. And one of the benefits of early modern scribal publication was that it allowed subversive, erotic, and obscene materials to travel under the radar of the censor. And this probably explains the copy of a letter to a friend that caught the clap. Manuscript acquired a certain aura, a political resonance associated with forbidden knowledge. Copies of private letters were transcribed, read, and preserved with a degree of care and attention not necessarily lavished on printed pamphlets. What we're often observing here is the way in which ostensibly personal correspondences, the letters between husbands and wives, between other family members, between monarchs and their subjects, in actual fact operating as highly public and political documents that worked in complex ways, both at the time of composition and initial circulation, and over the course of their textual afterlives as they entered informal scribal networks and acquired new meanings in different periods and in different contexts for subsequent readers. I turn now, however, to consider the ways in which letters circulated, and I begin with an examination of manuscript separates or single manuscripts, which survive in substantial numbers but often remain frustratingly elusive in bibliographic terms. They're often very difficult to date, very difficult to sort of find any sort of provenance for, unless they are accompanied by other textual materials. The scribal circulation of letters in the first stage of copying was often associated with the nominal author or signatory who orchestrated initial dissemination, though this wasn't always the case. There's concrete evidence of restricted circulation of letters among closely defined groups, which might loosely be termed coteries. While private or closed reading was not uncommon, it was widespread practice during the 16th and 17th centuries for everyday letters to be passed around trusted circles of family and friends as a way of distributing news, and individuals often circulated to third parties copies of personal letters for advice and information. Edward Stafford sent Walsingham a copy of a letter he'd written to Queen Elizabeth. Lady Margaret Hawkins sent Robert Cecil a copy of her rude letter of solicitation to Elizabeth I. In other words, it was commonplace for letters to be read by persons other than the addressee. An extension of this social practice is the controlled dissemination of multiple manuscript copies of letters. An instance of the tight control over initial dissemination is highlighted by the way in which copies of a letter from the Earl of Essex to the Privy Council in June 1596, a copy of which survives among the Seymour manuscripts recently deposited at Devon Record Office in Exeter, were carefully circulated in the first instance. Written prior to the Cadiz expedition, the letter outlined Essex's plan to seize a permanent base in Spain, contrary to Elizabeth's wishes. Delivery of the original was carefully delayed until the fleet reached a point of no return. Indeed, Essex entrusted its dispatch to his secretary Edward Reynolds, when I quote, "which you shall deliver, but not till the wind hath so served us at least a week, as you may judge us to be in Spain." A small number of copies were circulated at the time among a close circle of trusted friends. A correspondent sent a copy to Sir Thomas Kitson in Hengrave in Suffolk on the 23rd of July, 1596, writing in an accompanying letter, "I beseech you, keep it very private and return it safe enclosed in a sheet of paper when your worship may conveniently." This letter was part of a wider, well-orchestrated policy of Essex and his secretariat of circulating letters for propagandist purposes. His letter of advice to the Earl of Rutland, Henry Cuffe's true relation on the Cadiz affair, Essex's exchange with Lord Keeper Egerton, his apology published in Epistolary form to Anthony Bacon, and his penitent letters to Queen Elizabeth were all disseminated in manuscript. A letter to Elizabeth from Philip Howard, the Catholic Earl of Arundel, explaining his flight from England in 1585, introduces another dimension to the circulation of separates. The letter was apparently left with the Earl's sister, Margaret Sackville, to be delivered once he had reached France. It was alleged at his Star Chamber trial, however, that a copy was provided to a priest called Bridges, and I quote, "whereby they might be by him delivered abroad also, whereupon they were published and dispersed in manner of a slanderous libel after his departure. For the said Bridges caused diverse copies there of to be made by scriveners and to be published and dispersed in sundry parts." Once the Earl's capture was known, Bridges made public the letter, divulgating it among Catholics and discontented men. In 1589, at his arraignment, it was further asserted by the Attorney General Sir John Popham that 500 copies were made of the factious and traitorous letter of purpose for policy, which Bridges scattered abroad. Doubtless this figure is inflated for exaggerated effect. Nonetheless, the survival of numerous scribal copies indicates the degree of its circulation beyond any form of distinctly Catholic scribal community. In the case of Arundel's letter, and to a lesser extent Essex's, it is thus possible to discern distinct phases of dissemination. An initial controlled circulation followed by a less discriminate casting abroad of multiple scribal copies. In this rather more haphazard approach, copies of notorious letters were scattered for ad hoc transmission, or merely thrown abroad or cast into the street or posted up in public places in the same manner as verse satires or libels, an early modern equivalent to modern day fly posting. Such separates were produced in multiple copies, either by individual penmen, an informal group of scribes, or less likely by a professional scriptorium. In this way, the Jesuit priest John Gerard, in the aftermath of the gunpowder plot, sought to clear himself from charges of collaboration by writing an open letter in the form of a letter to a friend, declaring his innocence, and had copies of the letter made and scattered about the London streets in the early hours of the morning, one of which was picked up and shown to the king by a member of the council. In August 1599, a letter of the pretended Earl of Desmond to the King of Spain condemning Elizabethan actions in Ireland was found in the street by a justice of the peace and passed on to the Secretary of State, Robert Cecil, for examination. The letter had first been discovered by two bricklayers dwelling in the London parish of St. Clement's Danes, who assumed by the way that it was folded that it was not a letter, but in fact a handkerchief. Discovering instead that it was writing, the two men took it to the scrivener John Harwood to have it read, who, upon realising its seditious nature, advised them to carry it to John Morley, the constable, who in turn acquainted the Justice of the Peace with it. Justice Grange informed Cecil that he knew not whether the letter was only a copy, the true letter itself already having been made known. Now, this illustrates not only the range of literacies and illiteracies associated with early modern correspondence, but also the vigilance with which the authorities policed seditious materials of this nature. This is very much the sort of territory of Andy Wood and a surveillance state in the Tudor period. The copies of letters considered thus far have all been associated with particular individuals, though in some cases the lack of an autograph original makes attribution very difficult. And this is the classic case here is Philip Sidney's letter to Queen Elizabeth, sort of rebuking her about the Anjou match. In other instances, this method of casting multiple scribal copies abroad was used for anonymous letters. In February 1627, the mayor of King's Lynn forwarded to Lord Keeper Coventry a letter critical of the forced loan, a scandalous and pernicious paper directed to all English freeholders from a well-wisher of theirs, tending to the discouraging and withdrawing of the people's hearts from agreeing to any payments of His Majesty's loan. It had been found in the street in King's Lynn by one Robert Sims. Unable to read or write, Sims had shown it to a friend, who, perceiving the dangerous contents, sent it to the mayor. This was effectively an open, anonymous letter employing the epistolary form as a vehicle for subversive political ends. In practical terms, letters of this nature functioned as libels, which Andrew McCrae argues were broadly understood at the time as unauthorised and controversial texts, usually applied to verse, but I think it also works for letters. The circulation of copies of letters of this sort were termed libelling by contemporaries. Importantly here, circulation was indiscriminate. This was not the careful garnering of targeted support, but an attempt to influence public opinion, however one might define that. Copies were often dropped in prominent places to maximise impact. A letter dated 1627, which forecast imminent danger in May, was found in Norwich Street during the Lent Assizes in 1627. And place here was clearly significant. As Andrew Gordon has shown, the act of public posting of seditious materials conscripted public spaces traditionally associated with official communications, a spatial transgression that lent them a hardened political edge. Attention to the material conditions of circulation thus importantly shapes our understanding of reception. Once copies were in circulation, a healthy market seems to have existed for them. The Cheshire MP, Sir Richard Grosvenor, for example, collected various manuscript separates concerned with contemporary politics, including letters of Sir Francis Bacon upon several occasions, and the Lord Norris's letter to the King having slain a servant of the Lord Willoughby's. There's considerable evidence to suggest that these kinds of materials were readily available. Writing in April 1623, John Chamberlain informed Dudley Carleton that he had seen a letter of Lord Digby's to the king. And shortly after Raleigh's death, John Hollis asked his son to gather up as many of Sir Walter Raleigh's verses and letters as you can. It seems that certainly in London and in environments such as the Inns of Court and Parliament and the court itself, materials of this nature were easy to come by and were routinely exchanged. Individual transcripts were exchanged by hand and passed around individuals in a more targeted manner. Moreover, the letter itself was a key mechanism for the circulation of copies of letter texts. Writing from Paris in 1580, Sir Henry Cobham enclosed to Burleigh copies of The King of Navarre, his letter to his queen, and a letter from the Great Turk. Edward Lord Zouche sent to Thomas Layton a copy of a letter from the Pope to the king's sister, which he found in a package of letters dispatched to him in Guernsey, having already opened it and made a copy of it for himself. Politically noteworthy letters were circulated along with other kinds of topical materials, and of course accompanied digests of news from home and abroad. Fundamentally then, the letter acted as a kind of textual or cultural portmanteau, facilitating the broader transmission of other manuscript texts, prose, verse, libels, receipts, as well as in the wider dissemination of news, information, ideas, and scientific knowledge, something that is probably incredibly well known to this present seminar. Thus, early modern postal conditions and networks are central to understanding scribal circulation. And it's probably worth dwelling here just for a moment on the nature of postal conditions during the early modern period, prior to 1635. For much of the period, England was peripheral to well-established, universal and affordable public European postal structures, since the royal posts of both kingdoms were neither regularly maintained nor systematically open to the paying public. Prior to the emergence of a genuinely universal postal system with the founding of the post office after 1635, early modern postal arrangements were remarkably makeshift. Letter carriage was improvised during times of emergency and crisis, even at an elite and royal level, and largely dependent on local conditions and circumstances. Extraordinary posts were set up when the monarch was on progress, and in the late 1580s and 1590s, resources were poured into the western route from London down to Plymouth, to provide speedy postal communications at the time of the Armada and subsequent Spanish threats, as well as to deal with the war in Ireland. Throughout the 16th and 17th centuries, there were several different modes of posting, including ordinary posts, royal standing posts, pursuivants and royal messengers, foot posts, merchants' posts and carriers, both commercial and private, personal servants and messengers, and a myriad of idiosyncratic arrangements, including chance travellers who happened to be going in the right direction and could deliver a letter. All of which coexisted to form an interconnecting world of communications. A given individual might on the same day utilise several different methods of postal delivery, depending on availability of particular bearers or services, as well as the type and import of the letter. Likewise, individual letters might pass through many hands during their journeys. At the highest governmental level, delivery speeds were relatively swift, and historical geographers such as Mark Brayshay, who are interested in connectivity and the power of the state, have estimated that England in the late Elizabethan and Jacobean period was 3.5 days long and 4.5 days across for the level of government communication. Everything gets slower once you reach Plymouth, but it's just relatively quick. Now, there are methodological problems with working with these kinds of documents. A lot of them depend on the postal endorsements on the outer leaves of letters. And basically what this looks at is the speed of communications between distinct postal nodes. So if you're looking at communication, say from London down to the West Country, What you would find is that you can chart things going from the post of London all the way down through the postal stages to, say, Exeter. What you can't do is basically look at what is much more difficult to do is to look at speeds of delivery from hand to hand, because from things to come from the court to the post of London, there are several complex stages there, and again at the other end of the system, you've got to have it taken from the main postal node out into the provinces, and that's something that I can talk a little bit more about if people are interested. This period witnessed the inception and development of royal standing posts, which ushered in a new form of official mail carriage. But even here, letters and packets were prone to delays and losses, postmasters were poorly paid and often criticised for their negligence, and masters of the post themselves were targets of litigation and rebuke, all of which undercuts our understanding of the efficacy of official postal machinery. Furthermore, although there is some evidence of private letters being carried alongside official correspondence, standing posts were largely confined to governmental circles. The nobility and gentry employed personal servants as letter bearers, lending a highly personalised element to the carriage of letters, with the bearer acting as a corporeal extension of the correspondence in their charge. For most ordinary people, however, the carrier system remained the most affordable and semi-regular system of mail delivery, but at the cost of speed. Postal conditions and times also varied according to geographical location. For destinations off the main arterial highways or carrier routes, further arrangements had to be made on an ad hoc basis to carry letters onwards from the nearest postal node. Naturally, places closest to the major urban centres and main post roads experienced superior postal conditions. Carriage of letters overseas was also prone to significant delays. The irregular rhythms associated with postal conditions imparted a sense of insecurity to early modern epistolary communications. Delays and crossed correspondences were occasions of social anxiety, which disrupted the flow of the reciprocal exchange of letters. Threats of letters miscarrying, being intercepted and falling into the wrong hands, further heightened the degree of epistolary insecurity felt, which affected the very nature of correspondence, causing writers to self-censor and restrict what they committed to paper. Alongside these structural concerns developed an increasingly perceptible sense of correspondence as private, individualized, and the property of the addressee, which is reflected in the proliferation of personal writing technologies and solitary reading practices associated with letters. The desire for privacy also spawned a range of secret epistolary forms and clandestine or covert modes of delivery. To return to the main highway, however, of this paper, from which I've deviated for a moment here, I want to return to the dissemination of copies of letters. And it is clear that these travelled as enclosures with letters carried via royal post and carrier, and those of a more seditious or secretive nature were conveyed by trusted messengers or even transmitted by clandestine means for fear of interception. Furthermore, this kind of activity illustrates a significant overlap between networks of correspondence and scribal communities. As a method for the transmission of texts, private correspondence both preceded and facilitated successive and wider textual circulation. And work on the Republic of Letters and the Royal Society has done much to facilitate our understanding of scholarly networks of correspondence and the circulation of ideas during the second half of the 17th century. However, the study of the interrelation between correspondence networks and patterns of manuscript transmission has still to be undertaken properly for earlier periods. Typically, after an initial phase of orchestrated dissemination, we witness a second stage of unrestrained private copying prior to profit-based volume copying by commercial scriptoria, and also before later print publication, although certain letters appeared in print at the time. Thus, after it had entered the public world of the informal scribal network, a term that implies a national interpenetrating web of communications and exchange, circulation took place within and between scribal communities, based around individuals such as patrons, within institutions, universities, inns of court, the court itself, within the family and household, and between friends and business associates, local groups or county neighbours. Circulation achieved a more global dimension through diplomatic channels of communication, mercantile networks, and of course through the Republic of Letters. Unlike print publication, scribal publication, as Harold Love reminds us, took place not simultaneously, but consecutively, and the activity of production was dispersed, not centralised. Letters were disseminated as separates, as single bibliographic units, which survived as loose papers and were absorbed into larger groupings, circulating as part of a small number of related texts. And this can be viewed, for example, with letters and other materials associated with the Earl of Essex, with Francis Bacon, Walter Raleigh, materials relating to the Spanish match, which survive as discrete manuscript clusters. Bodleian Library manuscript Rawlinson D180, for example, is a composite volume which contains within it a separate manuscript pamphlet of Raleighana, including letters, his apology, and scaffold speech. A letter from Penelope Rich to Queen Elizabeth, soliciting on behalf of her brother, the Earl of Essex, survives in more than 30 variant manuscript copies, often packaged with texts associated with Essex. A National Library of Scotland advocate's manuscript 34210, folios 90 recto to 101 verso, was a distinct manuscript compilation in which Essex letters were gathered alongside related verse and prose documents. And copies of letters enjoyed a peculiar and complex afterlife, finding their ways into personal notebooks, commonplace books, letter books, or manuscript miscellanies, as well as latterly into professionally produced anthologies. Manuscript miscellanies of varying sorts are the most significant source of scribally copied letters, though as with separates, they are methodologically opaque, often difficult to date, collate, and establish provenance or biographical associations. Now, the term miscellany here, I think, is a very baggy one, that masks the complex way in which letters were copied. They were constructed in various forms, in various ways, formed from blank paper books into which texts were copied. These could be purchased, ready-made, or fabricated from separate sheets. They might also be assembled from separates, from small gatherings or paper booklets, which were collected together in large volumes, even professionally assembled from loose papers or rough copies. Miscellanies could be autograph or scribal, the work of an individual or multiple scribes, and composite volumes feature wide-ranging materials and hands. Letters were transcribed from manuscript and print sources, as well as transmitted orally, copied down as they were read aloud or from memory. In correspondence to Ralph Winwood, the professional letter writer John Pory quoted, "Some fragments whereof I remember from a letter from King James to the Lords he had heard read aloud by the Earl of Salisbury." Volumes were frequently the product of multiple compilers. They were passed from one individual or group to the next, with new material added or excised. They passed into the hands of antiquarians, were purchased by private collectors, and subsequently deposited in libraries and repositories. The long scribal working shelf life of these volumes means that it's often very tricky to know when material was added. The process of copying can occasionally be pieced together from marginal annotations. A collection of letters of historical interest dating from 1618 to 1628, containing among other items Raleigh's letter to James before his trial, the Earl of Bristol's letter to the Upper House of Parliament, is associated with the Puritan minister Robert Horne. Notes in the margins of this small quarto volume reveal something of the copying process, indicating that transcripts were made from disparate papers kept at residence in Clunbury, Ludlow and Westhope in Shropshire. And this can be seen from the headings, "The last of my writings at Clunbury," "They that follow are since my remove to Ludlow," and "All the following were written at Westhope." Separate notes also sometimes identify the copyist and the date of transcription, occasionally with additional comments or glosses. At least two of the articles, according to annotations, were copied out by the hand of Mr. Herbert Jenks of the Newhall, including a letter from the Archduke Palatine to the King, dated 1622. In several instances, the scribe notes when a letter was subsequently printed, as with the King's letter to the Speaker in the Commons House, printed since. The texts that were copied were far from stable and fixed. Early modern manuscript culture, as Arthur Marotti has shown, was far less author-centric than print culture at this period. And this imparted a strong element of what he describes as social textuality to the copies that we're dealing with. Texts were malleable and changeable. They were miscopied, they were appropriated, they were engaged with, and cast in new environments. And we're entering here the territory of stemmatics, the domain of critical and textual bibliography. Beyond the mechanics of copying and compilation, evidence of compilers, owners, scribes, and readers, although patchy, nonetheless offers clues about the regional dissemination of manuscript materials beyond the London orbit. And it maps in general terms the kinds of environments in which the circulation of letters flourished, and the sorts of groups, including women, actively engaged within manuscript culture. Elizabeth Littleton's Verse and Prose Miscellany, for example, Cambridge University Library Additional Manuscript 8460, included a copy of Raleigh's letter to his wife after his condemnation. Altogether more difficult to reconstruct are the precise details of the provenance and the provenance of materials and the networks through which they travelled. Indeed, Love notes that the fact that most personal miscellanies rarely record the circumstances of receipt of particular items and almost never those of further transmission, which disguises their dynamic quality as points of transit within networks of copying. A notable exception, however, is the Elizabethan Chancery official Sir Stephen Powell, whose manuscript networks have been painstakingly reconstructed by Jason Scott Warren. Powell documented the date, provenance, and even on occasion the onward circulation of the texts he copied, revealing a manuscript community based upon his workplace, family, household, and neighbourhood. Manuscript materials were thus borrowed, shared, and given by friends and acquaintances, circulated among interrelated and overlapping scribal networks that were cemented by ties of kinship, friendship, neighbourhood, a sense of shared educational experience or common profession, and by factional association or ideological persuasion. Another owner who noted the provenance of copy texts is the antiquarian and Kentish MP Sir Peter Manwood, whose example offers another type of circulatory network, that generated by scholarship and antiquarianism. Manwood's miscellany of transcripts of state papers was helpfully glossed in the margins. A copy of James I's letter to the House of Commons of 26th of June 1604 in the matter of subsidy was appended with the note that it had been written out of the printed copy. As with other manuscripts, this volume was produced by an anonymous scribe. However, throughout the miscellany, explanatory notes are appended in Manwood's hand, and most documents are labelled examined, signalling his habit of checking transcriptions against a copy text. An entry entitled A Replication Against the Claim of the Duke of York was, according to a marginal annotation, out of the Great Book of the Records of the State pertaining to the Council, suggesting that Manwood had access to official records, conceivably through his father, Sir Roger Manwood, Chief Baron of the Exchequer. Manwood also clearly enjoyed access to the state papers, since in 1612 the State Paper Office lent him correspondence of the English ambassadors to Constantinople dating from 1588 to 1611 for a history of the Turks. Manwood's example is not unique, and the public records were an important source of manuscript copying. While the first keeper of the records, Thomas Wilson, sought to gather and order state documents, private individuals could gain access for scholarly and political purposes. And his efforts were often very much in the face or against the backdrop of attempts by various sort of antiquarians to get hold of this material. Robert Cotton is a sort of prime example here, who Wilson describes as having conningly scraped together materials that he himself is trying to organise. But back to Manwood. Furthermore, Manwood was also well connected in antiquarian circles. In the 1590s, he exchanged collections of notes on English history with John Stowe, and in July 1606, Robert Cotton lent him Henry VIII's Life with certain notes. Manwood was a patron of scholars and translators, was well respected by Camden, and in 1617 was made a member of the Society of Antiquaries. Such connections offer another likely source for acquiring copies of correspondence. And the scholarly activities of antiquarian collectors like Cotton and Sir Simon's Jews represent another major factor explaining the preservation, copying, and circulation of letters. And various individuals borrowed from Jews' library, including Dugdale, Dodsworth, Selden, and Usher. And loan lists for Cotton's manuscript collections show that Hugh Holland was lent a book of letters of learned men to Mr. Camden, bound up in leather and clasped. And in 1608, Richard Bancroft borrowed a collection of royal and noble autograph letters. Antiquarian and scholarly interest, when considered alongside miscellany ownership and the circulation of separates, indicates a buoyant market for copies of politically interesting letters. And this was a market readily catered for by professional scribes such as Peter Beale's Feathery Scribe, who copied numerous letters, including a letter written by the Lords of the Council to King James and a letter written by Philip Sidney to his brother Robert Sidney. British Library Additional Manuscript 73087, which was probably owned by the Hampshire MP and Royalist Sir Richard Tichborne, was a volume of state letters, the table and contents and first 30 items of which are transcribed mostly in Feathery's hand. There is also some suggestion in relation to Sidney's letter to Elizabeth I of a more proactive form of copying, galvanised around a particular issue. Indeed, 11 of the surviving copies are associated with a Feathery scribe and his scriptorium, which Beale argues may represent an orchestrated attempt to represent Sidney as a champion of pro-Protestantism during a period of anti-Catholic sentiment. Professional scribes or scriptoria were therefore instrumental in producing single and multiple separates for targeted and wider dissemination, as well as in producing small pamphlets of related texts, and they were also active in producing bespoke miscellanies of letters for personal or coterie consumption. Finally, copies of letters appeared in printed form, enjoying a complicated relationship with manuscript versions. Letters might be printed close to their appearance in manuscript, either as part of official strategies of wider dissemination or by enterprising printers. Lady Rich's letter to Queen Elizabeth, for example, was printed in 1600 with Essex's apology. Appearance in popular, cheap printed format ensured a text's widespread dispersal in manuscript. What this highlights is the intertextuality between these two media. Letters first appearing in handwritten form were seized by printers whose own published versions were then read and copied by hand into manuscript books. Letter texts that had long circulated in manuscript often appeared much later in printed form, confirming the reapplication of texts within different socio-political circumstances. In particular, from the Civil War period onwards, the kinds of letters previously regarded as state secrets were produced for consumption by a popular audience eager to read or own such historical documents. The politically charged atmosphere of 1645 witnessed the confiscation and subsequent publication by special order of Parliament of a number of King Charles's private letters under the title The King's Cabinet Opened. The correspondence of noteworthy individuals such as Francis Bacon, Sir Henry Wotton, John Donne, Toby Matthew were also collected together for publication at around this time. The mid-17th century saw the publication of general collections of state papers such as the Cabala, Scrinia Sacra, Scrinia Siciliana and the Complete Ambassador, which produced letters and documents from the reigns of Henry VIII through to Charles I. We also see at around this time the appearance of historical collections, like John Rushworth's historical collections, Fuller's The Sovereign's Prerogative, Nelson's An Impartial Collection of Great Affairs of State. The contents of several manuscript volumes closely resemble those of the Kabbalah, though difficulties of precisely dating these manuscripts makes it hard to tell whether they in fact predate the printed artifact. The textual relationships between these printed volumes of state secrets and their manuscript counterparts, not least the emergence of a distinct corpus of early modern letters, requires substantial further research and promises to shed important new light on the circulation of letters, not only on the circulation of letters, but also on manuscript networks in general. And there's a plug, if ever I've heard one, for the next book. Individual letters thus had a peculiar afterlife beyond their initial application and reception, moving from a supposedly private epistolary moment to a more public outing. They circulated, placed among related letters and non-epistolary texts, gathering bibliographic units as they snowballed and were read in different contexts. This movement of separates into larger units gathered together with new materials is a process that Harold Love has termed rolling archetypes. And as D.F. McKenzie has argued in a rather overquoted phrase, new readers made new meanings. One such letter that achieved wider currency in this manner, in manuscript and posthumously in print, was that of the administrator Thomas Allored to the Duke of Buckingham. Allored's missive is a letter of advice in which he urged the royal favourite to block the proposed Spanish match for Prince Charles. Written in June 1620, the letter warned that marriage to the Infanta would neither be safe for the king's person, nor for this church and commonwealth, because that thereby may be an inlet to the Romish locusts. The letter was widely circulated in manuscript as part of anti-Spanish match propaganda, and was doubtless consumed as current news. Despite suggestions that Allured was not in fact the author of the letter, he was arrested and consigned to the Fleet, and only released after issuing an apology. Applying David Colclough's argument about epideictic rhetoric, the letter may have been read in certain circles as a legitimate mode of informal counsel. Viewed from the state's perspective, though, it was an infringement of the royal prerogative. The letter was copied by several individuals, including Francis Fane, the Earl of Westmoreland, Archbishop Sancroft, the antiquarian Rolf Starkey, and a contemporary separate was tipped into the register of the Council of Wales and Marches, presumably because of Allured's connection to the council. It was also collected by John Rouse, rector of Stanton Downham in Suffolk, alongside other materials relating to the Spanish match, including satirical verses against the proposed union. It was also later printed, the text finding reapplication as anti-royalist Hispanophobic propaganda during the early 1640s at the outbreak of the Civil War, when it was twice published in 1642 and 1643 under the titles The Copy of a Letter Written to the Duke of Buckingham Concerning the Match with Spain and The Humble Advice of Thomas Aldred to the Marquess of Buckingham Concerning the Marriage of Our Sovereign Lord King Charles. By 1659, it found its way in truncated form into Rushworth's historical collections. It also features prominently in later 17th century manuscript collections of Kabbalah letters. Clearly then, Allured's letter had a contemporary purpose as anti-Spanish propaganda, circulating as a separate. It was then copied and collected as a polemical political tract throughout the 1620s and 1630s. And it resurfaced in popularity in the 1640s, printed as part of a series of political pamphlets published at the outbreak of the Civil War before its later consumption for antiquarian interest. In conclusion then, the scribal circulation of manuscript copies of letters was complex and varied, extending from the controlled and unregulated dissemination of separates through widespread private copying to professional scribal production and print publication. texts enjoyed a peculiar afterlife that complicates modern-day understandings of early modern epistolarity. Once copied entered manuscript networks, they were circulated as separates, as discrete bibliographic collections of related correspondence and other materials. They formed part of larger accumulations of general letters and were included in miscellaneous volumes of assorted genres. What emerges also is the high degree of intertextuality between oral, print, and manuscript media. Letters written to be read aloud were scribally recorded or memorized for later transcription. Printed correspondence was written out by hand, copied into miscellanies or notebooks. Manuscript copies were published by printers. Various manuscript forms and writing technologies facilitated scribal circulation. The letter functioned as an important conduit for transmission, intimately connected with postal and correspondence networks. The miscellany worked as a textual entrepot, allowing copies to be transcribed and passed on. The professional scriptorium catered for consumer demand. And finally, the personal manuscript collection, library or state paper office acted as a repository from which to borrow, an archive in which to preserve. Moreover, letters enjoyed a long archival life, generating new meanings as they were gathered with new materials and were consumed by new readers in contexts disconnected from those of their initial applications. That's it. We're done.